Space and astronomy aren't the only scientific fields to experience major breakthroughs this year. As NPR's Joe Pelka tells us, 2011 was a big year for medicine, too, and for the little critters who help make so much medical research possible.
When scientists want to test new therapies for cancer or heart disease, they frequently turn to mice for help. For most mice, this isn't the best thing that could happen to them. Being a research subject has definite disadvantages, at least for mice. But most people prefer a new therapy be tested in a rodent rather than making a human patient the guinea pig, if you'll forgive the twisted metaphor. So every year, mice get the latest therapies, and some of the time, they're cured. For example, Richard Weil works with a strain of lab mice that are prone to getting prostate cancer. Weil is at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
What we've done is we've vaccinated mice against tumors.
Weil says the vaccine is made from a special virus containing cancer cell genes. The modified virus energizes the mouse's immune system so it can fight off the cancer. The vaccine doesn't prevent cancer. Instead, Weil gives the vaccine to mice that already have tumors.
And in a proportion of the mice, in our best experiments, those tumors would actually go away.
I know that the goal here is not specifically to cure mice, but this is good news for mice.
It is good news for mice.
The good news doesn't end with prostate cancer. Scientists have reported progress this year in melting away all sorts of tumors, as well as promising treatments for a variety of other ailments. For example, Lois Smith of Children's Hospital in Boston has been studying an eye problem that afflicts premature infants and people with diabetes. The problem is caused by abnormal blood vessel growth in the eye that can lead to blindness. She's turned to mice to answer some fundamental questions.
How do we promote normal blood vessel regrowth? How do we prevent the abnormal new blood vessels from growing?
This year, she reported that giving mice omega-3 fatty acids, that stuff you find in fish oil, was a promising approach.
It decreases by 50% the abnormal new blood vessel growth.
This approach only works before the problem develops. It won't be much help for the three blind mice we've all heard so much about. But just as some therapies are tested in mice before they're tested in humans, some are tested in mouse cells before they're tested in live mice. Jeffrey Holt is also at Children's Hospital in Boston. He's found some genes that have the wrong DNA sequence in people with an inherited form of deafness. So he's working with mice that have the same problem.
The idea is then to replace those genes with the correct DNA sequence and hopefully restore function.
This year, Holt was able to correct that problem in mouse cells.
And that was done in vitro in a dish, and now we want to do it in the live animal.
So how far off are you from trying that, do you think?
We're pretty close. That's something we have planned in the next year or so.
So for that good news, mice still have to wait a while. Joe Pelka, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Our first story, Grandma's Got a Smartphone. No doubt lots of seniors received high-tech devices this holiday season. Now the challenge is figuring out how the darn things work. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has this story on a growing number of programs to guide seniors into the digital age.
Forget iPads or smartphones. The digital divide can come down to something as seemingly simple as a camera. Pamela Knorr in Bend, Oregon, discovered many seniors have been given digital cameras by their children.
They were going around town taking all these great pictures that they wanted to send to their family members and couldn't figure out how to connect the USB port or take out the SIM card.
Knorr heads the Central Oregon Council on Aging. Her own elder parents often need tech help, and the light bulb went off one day as Knorr, yet again, put her parents in touch with, who better? Her teenage kids.
So I thought, you know, if my parents need it, I think probably other seniors need it too.
And so was born Tech, Teenager Elder Computer Help. 84-year-old Sigrid Scully signed up because she was struggling to stay connected with far-flung family.
My kids were not returning calls. They don't write letters. They are so knowledgeable about texting and email. And so I needed to get to know how to do that.
Scully worried she'd never catch on. She'd read a computer manual once, but didn't understand words like icon or cookies. She says her teen tutor was personable and used plain language.
So many teenagers think that seniors are just old people that don't know anything. And actually, the camaraderie and the knowledge that we can transmit to one another is so wonderful and so helpful. And I had that feeling with this class.
It has made me think about what life was like without Facebook and the internet.
Tucker Rampton is 15 and has helped train more than a dozen Oregon seniors. He's been surprised to have to explain email, something he thought everyone knew. Then again, a lot of seniors ask him about Twitter, which he admits he knows nothing about. Rampton says teaching tech to seniors has changed his perspective.
Well, I think it's a very good idea to work on your patience and, you know, be more understanding when it comes to what's going on in their minds.
At Pace University in New York, college students tutor seniors in local retirement homes. They're prepped with sensitivity training.
So they get to feel what it's like to be 70, 80, 90 years old because they wear specially prepared glasses that give them different visual impairments.
Program director Jean Coppola also has them do things like tape two fingers together to simulate the effects of arthritis or a stroke, then try to navigate a mouse. By the time they're at the computer with an elder, Coppola says they're not frustrated at all.
They'll say something like 100 times because they've worn cotton balls or earplugs in their ear. And they understand that they have to speak up, articulate their words.
Coppola says the whole thing is a bonding experience for both generations. Applause often breaks out the first time a senior receives an email. Some have been able to see new grandchildren for the first time through emailed photos. Pamela Knorr in Oregon says young trainers also gain new confidence from their interaction with seniors.
They're not criticizing me for the way I'm dressing or clucking their tongue. They're actually respecting me for the knowledge base that I have.
Perhaps most unexpected, some teen trainers and seniors have even become friends. They keep in touch long after class ends, through Facebook, of course. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Americans' sense of insecurity came in part from the stock market, which rose and fell in breathtaking ways this year, especially over the summer. It was normal for a while for the market to drop by hundreds of points, only to rise by hundreds the next day. As we near the end of this year, though, the market is up modestly from the start of the year, around 500 points. And it turns out that even with the nauseating turns in this market, many technology firms raised a lot of money when they went public. NPR's Aarti Shahani reports.
About the same number of technology companies went public this year as last year. Difference is, they managed to raise over $6 billion, a whopping 85% increase over 2010. Compared to all other industries, tech companies saw the highest returns in the first week of trading. 2011 was the year of mega brands. The biggest name in the mix, Groupon.
Groupon opens its first day of trading on the NASDAQ this morning.
It raised half as much as Google did when it went public. A splashy debut for sure. Turns out, though, it may be a washout.
If you want, buy the coupon, don't buy the stock. Buy the coupon, not the Groupon.
That's Sam Hamada. He's the CEO of Privco. He analyzes the financial data of companies across sectors. He says tech is a great investment because it makes valuable products with low labor costs. But for Groupon, that's not the case.
Once people looked under the hood, they realized really Groupon has no proprietary technology of any significance.
So if it's not tech, what is it?
Groupon effectively is a local advertising and couponing company. What that requires is a lot of local salespeople. It's a very labor-intensive business.
Groupon stock is worth less today than its closing price on day one. Not a great sign. Though not as bleak as Zynga. Zynga is the maker of Farmville, the popular game on the social network Facebook. The company mints real dollars by selling imaginary goods, like tractors that plow cornfields that only exist on a computer screen. For the vast majority of companies that go public, stock on day one closes higher than the initial offering price. Not Zynga, even though it priced its stock low. Investors lost real dollars. It's the textbook definition of a busted IPO.
It's embarrassing to the investment banks that took them public. A failure by almost any measure.
Though not when you measure how much Zynga raised. Peter Coles is a professor at Harvard Business School. But you don't have to teach there to know.
$1 billion is a fantastic amount of money to raise for Zynga.
For anyone, in fact. Zynga's IPO is the biggest tech IPO since Google's in 2004. The biggest success story this year was LinkedIn, the online Rolodex. It had a first-day pop. Investors paid well above the asking price, and the stock today is worth 40% more than when it debuted. On the surface, it makes no sense. The millions of people on LinkedIn don't even pay a dime. Why would investors pay? Coles explains the business model.
LinkedIn has become the number one tool for passive job search. That's where you are. That's where your contacts are. It's not worth our time to join another LinkedIn Rolodex-like substitute, and recruiters are willing to pay a lot of money for access to this fantastic user base.
The company, it's like a party host. One side comes in for free. The other side, in this case the headhunter, pays to enter. It's a strong network, an industry best practice. Losing your user base? That's a worst nightmare. Zillow is among the smallest companies to go public this year. Zillow lets people look up real estate prices in real time, even through cell phones. CEO Spencer Raskoff says that short of a strong network, you've got to inspire loyalty.
It's all that more important in technology for products and services to tug at an emotional heartstring. Another website is just a click away. Another mobile app is just a click away.
The most anticipated tech IPO in 2012? Facebook.
The beauty of Facebook is that it is impossible to leave.
Facebook is the best of the 2011 companies on steroids. Tech savvy, strong network, loyal users. Some say it's worth $100 billion. We'll know for sure when it flexes for public investors. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Two bills to stop online piracy are being hashed out in Congress. In the House, there's a bill called SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. In the Senate, there's the Protect Intellectual Property Act, people call that PIPA. Supporters say online piracy is theft of intellectual property. Opponents of this legislation say the bills amount to censorship. The latest scene to unfold in this saga involves a boycott of a major internet player. Declan McCullough is the chief political correspondent for CNET. Good morning, Mr. McCullough.
Good morning.
Now, there is a boycott planned today of GoDaddy, a company that sells domain names, .coms, .orgs. Explain to me why the opponents of this legislation think boycotting GoDaddy makes sense.
GoDaddy is one of the most prominent supporters of this legislation, which is backed by Hollywood. And they testified in front of Congress in support of the Senate version. They sent out a statement endorsing the House bill. So this is a way to teach them a lesson. And it worked in part. GoDaddy said that they no longer support the Senate bill or the House bill, but they haven't gone further and basically apologized completely. And so that's why the boycott is still taking place today.
The people who want this kind of legislation passed, Hollywood, the recording industry, people who have intellectual property to protect, what about the opponents? What's their position?
The opponents are Facebook, Google, eBay, Yahoo, Twitter, civil liberties groups, and human rights groups. It's not just Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. It's also copyright versus free speech.
And the sort of the freewheeling culture of the internet, the idea that you can do anything, say anything, post anything, people are concerned that that might somehow be restricted?
Well, it's probably been restricted over the last decade, but these Senate and House bills go further, and they try to levy a sort of internet death penalty against pirate websites. And the problem is, what happens when you have legitimate websites that might have some copyright violations on a minority of their web pages? When you levy the internet death penalty against an entire website or collections of websites just because of a few bad pages, that's where you run into these free speech concerns.
Now, why is it that the folks that are in favor of SOPA favor something like an internet death penalty?
Well, you have sites like thepiratebay.org, which Hollywood has been trying to get taken down or rendered inaccessible. They've mounted a worldwide campaign against it, trying to get ISPs in a lot of European countries to block access to it. And this is their U.S. attempt to say to internet service providers, you will not allow connections to thepiratebay.org.
What is next for these bills?
Well, both are moving pretty quickly. The Senate Majority Leader scheduled a floor vote for January 24th. And in the House, the supporters of the legislation have the votes in the committee. It's just that they ran out of time last week before the House adjourned for the holiday recess, and that'll resume next month. And so that's the next step, to see whether opponents can rally the troops and actually get enough opposition in place before the votes. And one wild card is whether companies like Google, eBay, Twitter, and so on will actually ask their users to call their senators or members of Congress before a floor vote. Imagine if companies that have a billion users combined did that. It would be something we just haven't seen before.
Declan McCullough, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Declan McCullough is chief political correspondent for CNET. He joined us from San Francisco. This is NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. That New Year's countdown has begun, not at the clock in Times Square, but this one for two NASA probes set to orbit the moon this weekend. The twin spacecraft, Grail A and Grail B, are expected to enter lunar orbit 24 hours apart, one on New Year's Eve, the other on New Year's Day. This marks the end of a 3.5-month journey for the washing machine-sized crafts launched from Florida in September. Just what does NASA scientists, what do they hope to do and accomplish? What are the pair of probes? What are they going to reveal about the Earth's closest neighbor 4 decades after man first landed on the moon? And how can twin spacecrafts chasing one another in circles help reveal the inner secrets of the moon? Why do we need two of them to do? Yeah, all interesting questions. All here, we're going to try to get them answered by Dr. Maria Zuber. She is principal investigator for NASA's GRAIL mission. Dr. Zuber is also a professor of geophysics, head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at MIT. She's at WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Zuber.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be back.
It's always good to have you. Tell us about the purpose. Why now, after all these years, do we send two of these probes to the moon?
Well, the various countries of the world have sent over 100 spacecraft to the moon, and there's still a lot of fundamental things that we don't understand about the moon. Most of these missions have studied the surface of the moon in various capacities, whether it be imaging craters and mountains or learning about composition, studying lunar samples. But fundamental things such as why the near side of the moon is different from the far side of the moon still aren't very well understood. And so it occurred to us that the answer might not be found on the surface. The answer might be inside of the moon. And that's what this mission proposes to study.
And what part of the inside of the moon are you trying to study?
From crust to core, we'll be producing a very precise map of the gravitational field of the moon. In fact, when we're finished with this mission, the gravity field of the moon will be known better than the gravitational field of the Earth. So it will be quite accurate.
And why do we need to do that? I mean, why specifically the gravitational field?
Gravity is one of the fundamental things that we try to study on the inside of a planet. Gravity studies the distribution of mass in the interior. So if we know something about what the composition is on the surface, if we know the size of the body, and if we know the mass, then we can understand what the what I'll call radial distribution of mass is in the interior. So we can learn about the crust, the mantle, and if the moon has a core, we will study that as well.
You do say that the moon is a mysterious place, that the side facing us is different than the side further on the other side. It's also mysterious because we're not quite sure how the moon was created, are we?
Well, I will say the only theory for the formation of the moon that doesn't have a fatal flaw is one where the moon was formed due to the impact of a Mars-sized body into the Earth. This impactor hit the Earth at a relatively high angle. And the core of this impactor is thought to have wrapped itself around the core of the Earth, and parts of the crust and mantle of the impactor and the Earth were thrown off into orbit and were thought to have formed the moon, or perhaps even more than one moon, as a recent theory has suggested.
And will these studies with these twin
satellites of the moon. Will they tell us any more about that process?
Well, it's certainly hoped that that would be the case. The recent study suggesting that the Earth may have, in fact, had more than one moon back in time after this gigantic collision took place came out relatively recently. It came out this spring in a paper in Nature, and it wasn't something that we had conceived of when we had written the proposal to do the GRAIL mission. But the idea shows some plausibility, did some calculations to demonstrate plausibility, and it laid out specific ideas that can be tested by understanding things about the inside of the moon. So the idea behind this second moon theory is that a moon about a third of the size of our current moon was in the same orbit around Earth as our moon was. And because it was in the same orbital plane, it wasn't moving very fast in comparison to our moon. And so it was stable for some period of time, but eventually it became unstable and drifted towards our moon and impacted it. But because it was moving at about the same, very close to the same velocity of our moon, it behaved very differently than normal collisions that we have on planets. Normally, when we have a collision on a planet, what happens is a great deal of kinetic energy gets thrown into the planet and a big hole gets excavated, which forms an impact crater or an impact basin. And if you look at the surface of the moon, Mercury, any of the solid planets, you will see a heavily cratered surface. Well, because of the fact that this collision of the Earth's or the moon's purported companion was at a very low velocity, it actually adds more material to the moon than it excavates. So instead of forming a hole on the moon, it formed a mountain. And one of the puzzling things about the backside of the moon is that there is a huge highland area in the equatorial region of the moon, which does not occur on the moon's front side. There have been a lot of ideas about what this mountain might have been due to, what would produce a mountain on one side of a planet and not another. And one of the ideas is that it could be the remnants of this collision of an early moon.
Fascinating. Would some pieces have drifted away, or would they all still be on the moon, the remnants of that second moon?
Certainly, I think some parts of the moon would have in the collision are lost from the moon, but the bulk of it, the preponderance of the material, actually sticks with the moon and adds to its mass.
It's fascinating.
A remarkably creative idea. And actually, the simulations that were shown demonstrate it, that it's plausible. I mean, it doesn't prove that it was the case, but it lays out some things that one can look for in the inside of the moon to test whether or not this was the case.
So your twin grails, A and B, can help solve that problem?
They certainly can. They will provide information that will allow us to evaluate that hypothesis. So we can either at that point reject it, or it may need to be modified on the basis of what we find or demonstrate that it was correct.
Well, it's a sort of serendipitous that you designed this way before that whole hypothesis came up.
That's correct. We had plenty of other interesting things that we wanted to look at, but it's remarkable that having studied the moon for so long, that there are still great new ideas about the moon and the Earth-Moon system. I mean, the Earth is the Earth is involved in this this whole process of what was going on back then.
Wow, and I understand that even though you've dubbed these satellites Grail A and Grail B, their names are going to change.
The names are going to change soon. So
Do we know what they are yet?
I know what they are.
Just tell me, okay?
you and all the many listeners of Science Friday, you will all learn soon enough. After the successful launch of the two spacecraft in September, we announced that there would be a naming contest, and we permitted schools and other student organizations to propose names for the spacecraft. And they needed, when they proposed these, they had to write an essay with the idea that that the names should in some way reflect something about the mission, something about the moon, something about the fact that the students realize that there are two spacecraft operating in a certain way. And so a group of us evaluated those names. And after the two spacecraft are successfully in orbit, we'll announce the winners.
There's also a moon cam, right? Kids can look at the moon?
Yes. In terms of the scientific payload, it's two spacecraft with the same instrument on each spacecraft, because the spacecraft make their measurement by ranging to each other. But what we decided to do is put cameras on the spacecraft, but not to give them a scientific purpose. The experiment is called MoonCam, and it's being run by Sally Ride, America's first woman in space. And each spacecraft has four cameras on it, which are pointed at different – two are looking at Nadir, which is directly below. One looks a little bit in front of, and one looks a little bit below. And these cameras have no scientific purpose. The purpose of them is totally education and outreach. And students and schools can sign up to be a part of the MoonCam project. It's targeted for middle schoolers. And students will need, in collaboration with their teachers, learn how to use the software. I imagine it'll be the students teaching the teachers how to use the software in a lot of cases. That's the way it often works. Schools will be assigned a period of time, and they will study the trajectory of the spacecraft and what parts of the moon they'll be passing over, and propose to take images. That'll be operated out of the University of California, San Diego, by Sally Ride Science.
And it sounds very exciting. There's a lot of stuff going on up there. Dr. Zuber, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us and making this educational opportunity available.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Maria Zuber is principal investigator for NASA's GRAIL mission, and she is also professor of geophysics and the head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at MIT. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to make a phone call, take a phone call from Antarctica. Yeah, live from Antarctica. We'll talk about research. You know, it's summertime down there. It's just beginning to heat up with the research. So we'll talk about what's going on down there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. How often have you thought, if only I could be in two places at once? Well, this year becomes more of a possibility by way of robots. While it's been a tough year for many of us humans, NPR's Laura Seidel reports for the NPR series A Good Year that it has been a good year for robots that stand in for humans.
Mike Fennelly isn't easily surprised by cutting-edge technologies, but when he started as an IT guy at a Silicon Valley startup called Evernote, there was a robot rolling around the office.
It was slightly disturbing for the not really knowing what the robot was for at the beginning and then going, okay, that's Phil.
CEO Phil Libin is also known as
a robotic overlord.
Well, Libin isn't actually a robot, but when he is out of town, his robot is still keeping an eye on things.
Get back to work. That's the usual robot employee interaction.
The robot looks a little like a stick figure on wheels. Its bulbous head has two eyes, which are actually a camera and a laser. On its forehead is a screen where you can see Phil Libin's face, and Libin can see employees like Andrew Sinkoff.
You know, it's probably better than having him actually be right next to me.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. When he's not around, this is a good way to communicate with him.
Libin is actually in the office today. He's just showing me how the robot works. But he is often traveling to his company's other locations in Japan, Austin, and Zurich. His company makes products that help people remember everything from chores, names, appointments, to random thoughts. He says using the robot to stay connected to his home office is better than a video conference program like Skype, which connects to a computer stuck in one room.
Whereas with the robot, yeah, I can just, you know, I can roll around. I can roll into a meeting that somebody else is having. I can sort of say, hey, what are you guys talking about? I can go up and look at the whiteboard. I can point at things with the laser.
Libin purchased his robot from a company just down the street in Mountain View, California, called Anybot. When I arrive at the Anybot offices, I can't find the receptionist. Then I turn around and there's a robot in front of me.
I'm the receptionist here at Anybots, which is one of the services that we offer, which is called the Any Lobby Service.
Angela is actually in South Carolina, but companies can buy a robot and rent her for a few hours at a time.
We can log in to several different locations all in one day and provide a plethora of different functions, you know.
Anybot was founded by Trevor Blackwell, who had been looking for a way to make robots popular. They've been searching for the, quote, killer app for robots. Don't think Terminator.
I'll be back.
Blackwell was looking for a program that would make robots popular the way spreadsheets popularized computers. He decided the key was robots that could help people be in two places at once.
And the need is there because travel gets more and more painful and expensive, especially overseas travel. So, you know, there are a lot of engineers here who are working with factories in Asia, and they need to see minute by minute what's going on there.
One of Anybot's telerobots costs about $15,000, which he points out is about the cost of one overseas trip. Ken Goldberg, a professor at UC Berkeley who teaches classes in robotics, thinks Blackwell may be onto something.
There's a lot of excitement because it seems to tap into this idea that we're increasingly busy.
Goldberg imagines that with our crazy schedules, many of us may find it useful to, say, send the robot to the office party while you're home with the kids.
Right now, we would consider it really weird and rude and inappropriate. But you could imagine that maybe after a while, that might be kind of okay. You're still there, right? You're spending time, but you're, you know, sitting in your pajamas at your desk.
Goldberg says just this year he saw several commercial companies like Anybot open up to sell what are called telepresence robots. According to Goldberg, the technology has finally reached the point where it's affordable, and with our busy lives, there's a growing need to do more, be in more places, see more people. But there is a downside, too. We may soon be in a world where there are no more excuses for not showing up. Laura Seidel, NPR News.